Welcome back to Dave's Gone By. Very excited to have with us a legendary musician to talk to. You know, they say that real musicians never really stop. They just keep going. So we have that with everyone from, like, the Rolling Stones celebrating their 50th anniversary and Bob Dylan's never-ending tour, to people like our guest, Jorma Kaukonen, who way back when was first playing acoustic guitar, then helping found the Jefferson Airplane, then playing with Hot Tuna, and now still playing with Hot Tuna as well as his solo work, and still doing tons of things. He's going to be at the Beacon Theater in New York with Electric Hot Tuna on November 30th and December 1st. He'll be in our neck of the woods in Denver in the middle of February. He's got a DVD of Electric Hot Tuna and celebrating Jorma Kaukonen's 70th birthday. I mean, so much that he's doing at this stage, and I think it's wonderful, and it's even more wonderful that he's in the neighborhood with us. Welcome, Jorma Kaukonen, to Dave's Gone By.
Hey, listen, nice to be here. Thanks for giving a darn.
Well, you know, people do give a darn, and it's not just because of, you know, that shining moment of Jefferson Airplane when rock changed. I mean, it's all the other stuff as well. So let's go right back to the beginning of when you first picked up an acoustic guitar.
Sure. Well, I was born in 1940, you know, so kids of my generation, we studied something. We always studied some kind of musical instrument. My instrument was the piano. And I took it for a number of years, probably up until the time I was like 8 or 9, maybe 10 years old. And I loved it because I loved music, but the instrument itself never set me on fire. And I guess it was in the early 50s, my dad worked for the government, and he had his secretary was this gal from Puerto Rico, and she and her husband were friends of our family, and they came over, and she came over one time, and she brought this nylon guitar and played some folk music from her homeland. And something about, I mean, even though that the Puerto Rican music wasn't my music, there was something about the instrument that called out to me, and I went, wow, and she showed me a couple of chords, and that was it for the next couple of years. Well, then, I guess it was probably in 1955, I met this high school, or high school buddy of mine, junior high school actually, a buddy of mine named Mike Oliveri, and he had a guitar, and I went to his house, and he was playing these songs, and the songs he was playing were like Carter Family songs, and some of the popular music of the time, Lou Luvin Brothers. You know, I come from Washington, D.C., so there were no demarcations about music. There were no categories like we have today. It was just popular music. So there was rockabilly and just everything you could possibly think of. Well, anyway, I said, wow, I like the guitar. So I told my dad, I want to play the guitar. And, of course, my dad goes, well, we're going to have to buy a guitar. You're going to have to prove to me that you're really serious about it. You need to learn two songs. So I went back to my buddy Michael, and he taught me two songs. And as my fading recollection tells me, is probably Down in the Willow Garden, a murder ballad, maybe Worried Man Blues, something like that. So I learned these two songs, and I played for him. And my father was sort of repulsed by my choice of music at the time. But having met the standards, he bought me a guitar, and I started to take some lessons.
Now, when you say you had to learn those songs, you're not talking about just chords and singing along. You were picking, you were playing the whole song.
When I got into the guitar, I wasn't interested in being quote-unquote a guitar player. I just wanted to sing songs.
Oh.
So yeah, I was picking because I was using it, but not, you know, it was basically accompanying myself, kind of like the way Johnny Cash played.
Oh, okay.
We loved Johnny Cash back then, too.
So at what point, though, did it go from being, wow, I really want to sing and play guitar and learn it properly, to realizing that you had kind of a special gift with the instrument?
Well, I just had so much fun with it. Like I said, I just wanted to sing songs, and I accompanied myself, and I loved that. But it would have been in 1959, 1960, when I was going to Antioch College, I met this guy, Ian Buchanan. He's since passed away, unfortunately. And he was a friend of Reverend Gary Davis's and a very fine guitar player. Now, Ian's muse, I didn't realize at the time, I realized later, was Lonnie Johnson. He was more interested in jazzy kind of stuff. But when I heard him play Reverend Davis's material, I fell in love with that. And for some reason, he took this sort of like gawky, awkward, thrashing, you know, guitar player, which is kind of how I look at myself in those days, and basically by painstaking patience, started to teach me to finger pick. And when I started to get into it, I realized that that's where I needed to be.
Huh. And so did, again, was it you going to be kind of a folk singer-player just before the whole mid-60s Jefferson Airplane thing kicked in?
You know, Jack and I had a little rock band in 1958 together.
Oh, wow.
Jack Cassidy. And, you know, but basically, like I said, I never really thought about categories of music. I just played songs that I liked. And but when I got into the fingerstyle thing, I wanted to be, you know, the great folk scare was starting to happen then.
Right.
And I knew that I wanted to be in that crowd.
Well, did you, how much headway? I mean, did you go to New York and start playing the bigger end? And
well, yeah, right.
Well, really?
I did go to New York in 1960, and I did play at Hoots and Gertie's Folk City, and got lots of little gigs with different people around, you know. But, I mean, it was so happening back in those days. I mean, everybody, it would seem like everybody was out playing or doing something, and you know, obviously the bitter end would have been over my expectations. I was just a non-entity kid who just came there from Ohio. But the fact was is that it was so exciting. It was all going on, and, you know, Bob Dylan was in the Village at that time, and Dave Van Ronk, and Reverend Gary Davis, of course. Brother John Sellers was running the Hoots at Gertie's Folk City.
yeah.
What can I tell you?
But that part of it, I mean, you did not become a Phil Oakes, a Peter, Paul, and Mary. You took a different path.
I was really sort of unaware of Phil Oakes. I was more interested in the picking stuff. I love the, you know, there's some of those Peter, Paul, and Mary records I got to tell you that I love. But as far as playing music, that was considered commercial folk music.
Mm.
And I wasn't interested in learning to do that. First of all, I didn't know how to sing vocal harmonies, and that was really what they were all about. Like I said, I loved that record. I think the first Joan Baez record was the one that really helped sort of like direct me, even though Joan is certainly not a blues player, but that's that first Joan Baez album, it, to this day, I think is a stunning, stunning album. And all those things helped open the door to where I needed to be, which was, in my case, sort of examining Reverend Davis and just playing as much as possible.
And yet, somewhere in there, moving towards the middle 1960s,
right,
you jumped into rock and rock blues.
Right. Well, I graduated graduated college in 1965, and up to that point, I was getting a lot of gigs as a solo artist around the Bay Area. I was going to the University of Santa Clara, and I was in the Bay Area, and I got lots of gigs and stuff like that. Well, Paul Kantor had he and Marty had started what would ultimately become the Jefferson Airplane. And they asked me, they needed a lead guitar player, so they asked me to audition for the band. Well, I knew nothing about being a lead guitar player or any of these things, but they liked my playing. So by a curious set of happenstance circumstances, I wound up in what would become the Jefferson Airplane. But mind you, I never really, even though Jack and I played in the band in 58, I'd never really, quote-unquote, really played in the band, so I had no idea about the dynamics that were necessary, the styles and stuff. So, but the Airplane rehearsed endlessly. We rehearsed endlessly, and as a result, I got an unbelievable opportunity of on-the-job training. Hey, this is Jorma Kaukonen, and you are listening to Dave's Gone By on UNC Radio.
Now, is it true that you were the one who kind of came up with the name for Jefferson Airplane?
No.
It was a goof thing? Oh, no.
Way before the rock thing started happening, all of us that were in the sort of folk blues world were joking about, you know, how long do we have to be in this game before people can take us seriously, etc. And a friend of mine, his name was Richmond Talbot, he's passed away also since then, was coming up with funny names for all the blues players. And Tom Hobson was Blind Outrage, Steve Mann was Little Son Goldfarb. And he came up with Blind Thomas Jefferson Airplane for me. I never used it; it never appeared in the handbill. But it was just sort of like funny stuff. So when the folks in the Airplane, what would become the Airplane, were talking about naming the band, they were coming up with all these really stupid names. And my comment was, "You want a really stupid name? How about this, Jefferson Airplane?" And they went, "Wow, it's a great idea." And I went, "It is."
Well, you did. So you did, actually. I mean, it was given to you,
I mean,
but you bequeathed it.
So, I brought it to the band, and much to my surprise, they loved it.
So what do you think is the greatest, most important legacy of Jefferson Airplane, either to music or to culture?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think the Airplane, you know, when I look back on it now, the Airplane is an extremely talented band. I think one of the things that we certainly brought to the table was we were the first band to be signed to a major deal. We kept our publishing. We were involved in producing ourselves, which everybody does today, but which nobody did back then. And so in a lot of respects, we were sort of like firsts. And I think that basically we showed people that followed that there's a lot of ways to approach popular music. You know, you can write songs with hooks, or you can have that chemistry that makes people interested in what you're doing. Now, keeping in mind also we were in the 60s, so and a lot of our writers, you know, Paul, Marty, and Grace were very political writers, so there was that thing too. But over you know, as time elapses, the timeliness of some of the political writing, I think, is not as relevant as it once was. But the emotional content of being able to pretty much do whatever you wanted to do and make it palatable to the public, that's something that's important.
By the way, we are talking with Jorma Kaukonen, and just having a fabulous time talking to you and hearing these memories. I am kind of curious, you know, the Jefferson airplane morphed into the Jefferson Starship, but you didn't go there. You decided to stay with...
Jack and I quit the airplane in 72, you know, we owned the name along with the other band members, and so they couldn't keep that name. And, you know, people make... You know, the Starship was, a hugely successful pop band. And, you know, a lot of people go, oh, you know, the Starship, good thing you got out. And I went, look, you know, the key word in the two words music business is business, because even though you want to do what you want to do, you also want to be successful at it, and that's what they wanted to do. I mean, you know, people make a lot of sport of that sort of funny song they did, We Built the City on Rock and Roll. I think it was one of the co-holders of one of the worst rock songs of all time. I went, listen, it's not my favorite song, but guess what? It sold millions of copies. I wish I wrote that song.
Right. Well, yeah. I mean, I wish I wrote Feelings.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, here's the thing, too. You know, we all go where we need to go. Jack and I, you know, we followed our muse to Hot Tuna. And, you know, it is true that I've never had big hits like Marty and Paul and Grace had with the Starship. But you know something? The Jefferson Airplane made the folky thing that I did palatable to a lot of people that never would have known about it. Now, of course, you know, lots of people know about that kind of stuff today. There are a lot of unbelievably great players that play in my style, you know. But at the time, I would probably venture to guess that many of the people that gave us a listen, had they not been sort of like, had the door hadn't been opened by Jefferson Airplane, they might not have never become aware of us. So the airplane has made it, but the airplane's success, God bless them, has made it possible basically for me to be a very decently paid folk musician for the rest of my life.
Nothing wrong with that.
No, there sure isn't, you know. And I've always, I've always been able to do pretty much exactly what I want to do. Nobody's told me what songs to record or any of that stuff. You know, it doesn't get much better than that.
Well, let me ask a question, because you've been doing acoustic Hot Tuna, electric Hot Tuna,
right,
as well as your solo work for all these years. I'm wondering, how do you decide? It's one thing to know that something you want to do doesn't fit with Jefferson Airplane, so you're going to do it yourself,
right,
or with Tuna, but how do you know what's a solo thing or what's a Hot Tuna thing?
There's a really fine line there, you know. Like, I've done a number of solo projects, as I'm sure you're aware, and people are always asking me, how come you didn't get Jack to play bass? And the answer is, because then it'd be a Hot Tuna thing. And then they go, well, kind of like your question, well, why isn't it a Hot Tuna record? Well, one of the things it has to do with is whether Jack has something else going on, if he's available to do something. And the other thing is that when Jack and I play together, one of the things that I think that many people listen for is that chemistry, that interaction that occurred between Jack and myself, because we've been playing together for so long. And it's something I can't define either, but we've had it for years, and it's a really great place for us to go. Now, when I do my solo projects are not really solo. I always have lots of side men and stuff like that to help me. With a solo Jorma project, it's pretty much more about the songs rather than that chemistry and interaction. I work on the road all the time myself. You know, I tour with my buddy Barry Mitterhoff, excuse me, most of the time, and he plays mandolin and all these different instruments and stuff. And when I play with Jack, I guess there are probably some songs, some Hot Tuna songs that we would play with Jack that I wouldn't play without him, because I depend on him to be Jack.
Right. Let me ask, a couple of other things about who you are as a person. Back in 1979, you started getting tattoos, and you have quite a few of them.
I do.
It took 20 years, I guess, for the rest of the world to sort of catch up and make tattoos incredibly common. I mean, what was your reasoning way back when?
Well, you we were just joking about that. But actually, I got my first tattoo in the 60s. I got my first tattoo. You know, the whole tattoo thing, you know, by the body art thing, has been elevated to an art form. I got my first tattoo in a tattoo shop on 7th Street, which is a seedy street in San Francisco, over the Greyhound station. And that was part of the charm. And I guarantee that that was not a work of art. Now, that tattoo that I got was the little thing on my back. Has long since been covered up by an Ed Hardy back piece, which I did get in the 70s, which was a work of art. It's kind of funny. Why did I get a tattoo? I don't know. There's something about it that appealed to me. You know, I've got a 15-year-old teenage son, and sometimes he asks me, "Dad, are you going to get any more tattoos?" And I'm going, "No, I don't think I am." You know, and he goes, "If you were my age, would you get tattooed again?" I said, "Well, you know, to be honest with you, probably not. Because." I'm talking about the way I feel today. I'm not thinking about getting more tattoos. So if I took that mindset back then, I probably wouldn't get them. But I love them. I've never had a tattoo removed. I'm not going to have them removed. And I encouraged him when he gets old enough to think about it to think carefully because they don't go away.
Right. That's what I want. You know, I have to admit, I've never been a fan. I don't have any. But it's curious to talk to people who were doing it way before.
There's been a lot of different stuff from people. I mean, there's a lot of like totemization where people. You know, attribute like, you know, powers to whatever, or, you know, alter egos to the stuff they get. I mean, there's a lot of reasons to do that. I think when I first got it, it's just, I probably got it because my parents wouldn't have liked it.
Ha! Okay. That's right, your dad. Let me ask, speaking of which, you know, your dad was in government service.
Was.
Did moving around a bit when you were a kid prepare you for a life of touring?
You know something, I have a 6-year-old daughter also, and she... She's at a point in our life where she's unhappy when I go away, and I explain to her that I'll be back, and we try to talk and all this kind of stuff. And I explain to her that that's just the way it is because that's my life. That's how I do it. And when I think back, the answer is probably yes. You know, my dad was posted in a lot of different places. We traveled all the time. I was rarely in one place for more than 2 years. 3 years was, like, unbelievable. And so that's always been a part of my life, and I guess in some ways... It makes it feel more normal than for somebody that had never done that to all of a sudden find themselves in a touring job.
Huh. Let me ask, you're 71 now, am I right?
That's right. I got 72 coming up this year.
So you have a 6-year-old daughter?
I do.
Congratulations, man. What was the decision-making process behind that?
Well, you know, like I said, I have a 15-year-old son that lives with his mother in Virginia, and Vanessa, the lady that I'm married to, she wanted to have children. We couldn't have kids, and so we adopted a little girl from China.
Oh, cool.
And it's just, you know, we just wanted kids, and, you know, she's a joy. She's really a joy.
But, you know, being... Now, of course, you're...
By the way,
yes, right.
Being raised Jewish.
Oh, well, mazel tov. So, I was going to ask about that, because you are partly Jewish, which I had
My mom is Jewish, which makes me Jewish. My wife converted 7 or 8 years ago, and even though I was raised in a very secular family, I went through whatever the process for, you know, natural-born Jews do to find out about that stuff. And it was very interesting. I took I did the biblical Hebrew courses and all that stuff. And had I paid more attention, I'd probably remember more, but we did services and all that, you know the deal.
But so it, was it important to you that your daughter be raised in the faith?
Well, you know something? It's very funny because... You know, my grandparents, my maternal grandparents came from Russia. You know, they're Russian Jews, and they obviously came over because of the pogroms in Russia in the late 1800s and all that stuff. So, growing up, because my dad was gone a lot at the time, my mom lived with my grandparents, and so my cultural milieu, if not being around, you know, because I certainly wasn't around really, really observant Jews, but I was around all these Russian Jews. That was normal to me, you know? Like, if you ever saw that movie Avalon,
sure.
About the Jewish family in Baltimore, that's my family. I mean, the picnics, just the whole deal, you know, and there it is, you know? So I never gave it a second thought because that's just how I grew up, but I think it's important for anybody, no matter what their faith or orientation is, to have something comfortable to go back to, and that's what we're offering our daughter. She also studies Chinese, too. You know, because she is from China, but I think, you know, it's kind of funny. She's not totally wild about it. And just the other day, she was telling me, "I don't see why I have to study Chinese just because that's who I am." And I went, "You know something?
Well, yeah. Although she's studying it because China will own the universe in about
20
years.
That's probably true, but she can always go back to it. I mean, you know, she can speak a little bit and she can write characters and stuff. But I think that she'd rather play the piano. And you want to know something?
Yeah.
I'm okay with that.
Well, because she's Jewish, she's playing the piano right to left, so it's
going
to be interesting.
That's right, exactly.
Sort of a thing. We're talking with Jorma Kaukonen, having a wonderful time talking about his life, his music, and but we're also talking a bit about getting older and having something to come back to. And it is, you are at the point of losing friends and losing people. I mean, how is it? And we were talking, of course, about Jack Cassidy before, your good friend, and he lost his wife a couple of weeks ago. So what is it like kind of seeing this attrition of people that you remember when they were teenagers, you know, in their 20s? What's that like?
You know, I mean, obviously, I guess, you know, we're all going to go sometime. I mean, there's no argument about that. And as you get older, that becomes, much more of a reality because that's just the way it is. And we would certainly like all our old friends to live forever. I just played at the Love for Levon benefit at the Izod Center in New Jersey a couple of weeks ago. And you know, I was just talking, there's just dozens of music luminaries there. And we're talking about all this stuff, you know, and you're right, there's fewer of us left because that's how it is. But, you know, the good news is that my wife is younger than I am. I work in the music business, so there are many people that are my contemporaries, but most of the people are younger than me. And so, except for the fact that I'm creakier than I used to be, I tend to relate in some way, I think, to the changing landscape of personalities, you know, and that's just how it is. And like I said, we all like to live forever, but I don't think that's going to happen.
Well, do you think it has affected your playing? Have you had to change certain things that you do?
Oh, sure, absolutely.
Really?
You know, I've got some arthritis in my hands, and I have to be careful. I need to warm up. You know, the day of the superstar is over. You know, you need to take care of yourself. The great guitar player Tommy Emmanuel, he was at our Purple Ranch not too long ago. And we were talking about. He says, one of his mentors was Chet Atkins. At the end of Chet's life, he was quite ill, and Chet told Tommy, you got to take care of yourself, because you don't want something to happen so you can't do what you love to do most, you know. So, yeah, I've had to make some changes. You know, I use a little lighter strings than I used to use and this and that. But, you know, the good Lord's been good to me. And I, you know, I'm a vigorous guy, and I can see, you know, if I make the proper preparations, I think I'm better than I used to be.
Well, I saw Chet Atkins in concert probably a year or two before he died. It was wonderful.
Yeah, he was really something, absolutely.
Now, you also mentioned in what you were just saying something called the Fur Peace Ranch.
Yeah.
If people don't know what that is, please tell us.
Well, you know, I live in Southeast. I live in a very rural area of Southeast Ohio, and the Fur Peace Ranch is 127-some acres of forested countryside. And in the middle of all of this is we have the Fur Peace Ranch, which is like a little, it's a music camp, a music school, and we're open from March through November, pretty much every other week. We have the class times are 4-day weekends, Friday morning to Monday morning. We also have a concert Saturday night. We have a local NPR radio show. We're busy.
Yeah, and then you do it for, you know, well, I mean, obviously you get something financial from it, but you also must do it for love, all the teaching and all that.
I do, you know. I mean, the Fur Peace Ranch, I could, you know, Vanessa and I couldn't support ourselves on the Fur Peace Ranch, but it's not costing us any money. And we employ 12 or 11 or 12 people full-time, local people. So, you know, we're local employers. Yeah, it's real important to us, the being able to give back the music thing and to be able to share our, what I consider to be an important sort of aspect of the musical community, absolutely trumps dollars and cents.
Now, one of the things that is so amazing to be talking to both you and I actually spoke with Jack Cassidy a couple of months ago, was that, you know, people might think, oh, they were in the Jefferson Airplane in San Francisco and the hippies in the 60s, and they're, you know, they must be burnouts. They must be, and you can hear just from the way that you're talking is that you're a tremendously clear and intelligent person, and your brain is totally all there. So I'm wondering, another quote that you had from an interview was, says that, obviously I've certainly done my share of substances over the years, and it's made me a lot of what I am today, even though I don't do anything today.
True.
So I'm kind of wondering how drugs did or did not shape who you are.
Well, that's a good question. I'm a recovering alcoholic, so that's part of my story, certainly. But and there's no question I wouldn't be the person I am today had it not been for all those experiences. I mean, you start out when you're a kid. You're not anything, you know. You try this, you try that. I didn't discover drugs until I was in my 20s, because in the year when I grew up, it just wasn't part of our culture like it is today. And obviously, that whole 60s thing when everybody was partying, relentlessly, obviously, I guess it had to shape a lot of the art and the thought processes, et cetera, et cetera. And at some point, it worked better for the other people, and for some people like myself, it stopped working. So, but I think that having, just from a point of having survived all that stuff, because that's the way I look at it today. I wouldn't have looked at it like that back then. It's just the way it was. But having survived all that stuff, I think it's made me a stronger person. I think it's given me it makes me more open-minded towards other people's foibles, and I'm totally a live and let live person. What works for me doesn't necessarily work for anybody else. I would never venture advice, because who wants to take advice anyway?
True. How long have you been clean and sober?
If I make it to December 1st, I'll have 16 years.
Was it a big struggle, or?
Sure, in the beginning, it's hard to look back on it. If it was easy, everybody would do it. If you're into the recovering community, the success rate is very low. It's a relentless disease, But it was in the beginning. I still go to meetings. I still do what I need to do, and by the grace of God, so far so good.
God willing, yeah. Speaking of substances, kind of an odd transition here, but I didn't realize that you worked on the Warren Zevon album, Transverse City. What were those sessions like? Because he was...
Well, that was interesting. I'll tell you, Jack was friends with Warren, and I guess Warren wanted Jack, and then he wanted me on those couple of songs, too. I remember the sessions. I never really got to know Warren very well, but I understand that he was something of an eccentric, and some people found him difficult to get along with, and some people found him easy to get along with. For me, that he brought they had a couple of great songs, and basically he just said, look, here's how the song goes, just be yourself. And I went, if I just wanted to be myself, I'd do my own project, be a little more specific. So I remember, because it was a long time ago, I remember he sort of gave us some direction. I want some little intensity here, I want this and that. One of the things, I think it was on Gridlock, one of the things I remember is he had an acoustic 12-string guitar that was compressed, was squashed into a sound that you didn't know what it was. And I remember thinking that was just the coolest thing I'd ever heard. Hey, this is Jorma Kalkin, and you are listening to Dave's Gone By on UNC Radio.
Can I ask if there are other folks like that that you've worked with, that you have great anecdotes or stories about, that you've sessioned with, since you probably know most everybody in the music business?
Well, I know. The thing is honestly, I've never really done that many sessions.
Okay.
I did some sessions for Robert Hunter for an album he did called Amagamblin Street back in the 80s. And it's funny. You get together with artists. And I've been very fortunate, because I've never really been in, except back in the day when the Airplane was recording at Wally Heider's, and there was excess going on with everybody that was there at the time. It wasn't just us, but the people over the years that have asked me to do stuff, it's really been interesting. And I think one of the most interesting sessions I ever did was Brad Silverling, who's a movie producer. Asked Jack and myself to be part of a soundtrack for a movie he did called Moonlight Mile about 10 years ago, and the guy who scored it was this guy Mark Isham. He used to play trumpet.
Oh, sure.
The Champlin, but he's a great movie scoring guy. I mean, he's done everything under the. And I remember talking to Mark. I go, listen, I don't read music, I really at all. There's going to have to be some hand holding. I know these guys are used to scoring stuff for the LA Philharmonic, and they cut a session in the afternoon. So they spent about 4 days, and they walked through with me and Jack, and we got a chance to work on this movie thing. It's the only movie I've really ever worked on, other than just contributing a song. And it was a fantastic experience. I got a chance to see a world that I normally would have never seen.
That's cool. Yeah, when I asked about other session people or people that you've just jammed with, or done concerts with, it isn't just to get stories about debauchery and
right.
substance. It's just cool memories.
Look,
I'm sorry?
I mean, the debauchery's been around for a very long time.
True, true.
And at some point in our life, most of us have those war stories to tell. But you know something, they really, you know, it's not that I just don't want to have anything to say because there's nothing new under the sun. I don't think that we were as debauched as many of my friends, and we were probably more debauched than some. I mean, you know, by the grace of God, I survived, and here I am today. But, you know, there's really nothing interesting in those stories because we didn't do anything that didn't happen in, shortly after Adam and Eve left the garden.
Can I ask what, who you listen to now? What musicians? What do you listen to the radio? What do you listen to?
Well, I tend to listen to... I like vintage country, you know, not country rock today, it's just country rock. Excuse me, I like older country, you know. I've just come back from a road trip, and on this last road trip, I've been listening to a lot of Alison Krauss, of all things.
Oh.
And the one I was listening to is an album that she made when she was a teen, Got That Old Feeling. Excuse me, where she's just unbelievable. I also have been listening to this singer-songwriter, Nashville singer-songwriter named Gretchen Peters, and mm-hmm. in the last year or so, I really got into Celtic music, which for some strange reason I never did before, and I've been listening to these songs by John Doyle and Karen Casey.
Nice. No, but that's still in your wheelhouse. I'm kind of wondering also if there's stuff you listen to that we'd be like, wow, you're listening to Kanye West or whatever, or classical or jazz stuff.
Okay, here's something that's a little bit out of the norm. Pitbull.
Pitbull? Is that a rapper?
Yeah, sort of, yeah. He had an ad. It was like a Budweiser ad or something. And I went, you know something? That's funny. I like that. And, of course, like I said, I got a son that lives in Northern Virginia. And he said, Dad, you got to check Pitbull out. So I checked him out. And I went, oh, that's funny. I can actually listen to that because it was entertaining.
Cool. Cool, and I have to say, it's been tremendously entertaining talking to Jorma Kaukonen. You got to pick up the Electric Hot Tuna DVD that celebrates Mr. Kaukonen's 70th birthday.
Yep.
He's now 71, going on 72, with many more to come, I hope. By the way, I never even mentioned this, I don't think, in our intro, that you were named by Rolling Stone as the 54th greatest rock guitarist of all time. I know that sort of sounds like a backhanded compliment, but 16th greatest acoustic guitarist. Well, that's pretty decent.
It's all that's flattering stuff. I mean, obviously, when we got into music when we were kids, my friend Chris Smith, a singer-songwriter, sums it up this way. I fell into it when I was a kid, and I never fell out of it. And that's pretty much my story, too. Obviously, we didn't think about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame because, you know, me and the boys and the girls are in that also, and all this kind of stuff. But when somebody likes you and you get some sort of award, even if it's like, wow, that's cool. I mean, getting recognition from your peers on some level, that's cool. We like that.
Yeah, really, that's a lot of what we do almost everything for. As long as we're eating and a roof over our heads, the next thing is hearing somebody say, yeah, that was good. You know, you got talent.
It's like, you know, I did a project in 2002 called Blue Country Heart that got a Grammy nomination, and you could have knocked me over with a feather. I mean, I would have never even considered that such a thing was possible. Hey, this is Jorma Kaukonen, and you are listening to Dave's Gone By on UNC Radio.
You know, I'm so glad that you're still out there exploring possibilities musically and in your life. I think, and we also want to tell people about the Fur Peace Ranch, if people are interested in doing that. And really, for a lot of information, you can go to jormakaukonen.com, JORMAKAUKONEN. You can look it up. If you spell it wrong, just Google it, and you'll find it easily enough.
Yeah, it'll pop right up.
So when is the next actual recorded music project that you're working on?
That's a good project. That's a good thought. I'm going to get on it for next year, 2013. And Jack's abroad right now, but when he comes back, I'm going to see if we're going to do, if the next thing will be another Hot Tuna project or a Jorma solo project. We just did a Hot Tuna project at Steady As She Goes a year and a half, 2 years ago. But I'm whatever he wants to do, I'm open to it because we're buddies, and that's what you do with your buddies.
Well, thank you for being a buddy to this radio show.
Well, thank you for being interesting, man, and you take care of that cold.
Thanks so much.